Welcome to All Movie Talk, where we're going to have a blast from the past here, a little bit more of a throwback to our older, more structured episodes, where we'll have a couple of segments, though maybe they're going to be a little more rambling than in the past. We are definitely going to bring back the trivia question, because Sam likes to torture me, so we'll see how I do on that one. We're also going to have a long discussion about film presentation and restoration, thinking about the various ways in which we watch older movies and how they're different when we see them today than perhaps when they were originally shown, whether that's a good thing, a bad thing, or a mixture of the two. And then finally, we're going to talk about a little independent film you may not have heard of. We're going to do a film spotlight on what's winning a lot of independent movie awards for last year, a movie called Avatar. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and I hope you are listening to this podcast in the way that we intended you to hear it, which would, of course, be the 7.1 surround sound. Because if you're not, I mean, don't even bother. Just shut it off right now. I mean, you're obviously not respecting the work that we're doing here. This mono track that we have mixed together for you on this podcast is just, it really can't be heard any other way. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Wait, mono? I thought you said this was 7.1. You're going to mix it in mono? Cause...
Well, it's mono, but it's designed for the 7.1 system.
Oh, I think they might need the Blu-ray. Just the download probably won't have the 7.1 track included, right?
No, see, there isn't one. It's just a mono track, but you have to hear it. You know what? Just stop the podcast now. I mean, don't even listen. I don't want to be insulted by you listening to it on substandard equipment. So I got a trivia question for you, just like the old days, and just as in the old days, I'm going to ask it for you here at the beginning of the show, and then not give you the answer till the end. That way you'll be forced to listen to the whole thing, because fast-forwarding and skipping around is not possible with modern technology, thankfully. Stephen, here's the question that you want to be thinking about.
Okay.
I'll be really impressed if you get it, but it's possible. So, kind of an unusual collaboration. What film did Mel Brooks and David Lynch collaborate on? Do you think you know this?
I mean,
that's a weird collaboration.
I know. I'm kind of confused by the word collaborate. I feel like this might be a trick question.
No, it's absolutely not a trick question.
No.
In fact,
not
I can even
question.
Tell you a bit about the what the collaboration was.
Oh, yeah.
Mel Brooks. I don't think he was the producer, but he was an executive producer, maybe, and he wanted to get a movie made, and he thought David Lynch would be the perfect one to direct it, and so that's what happened.
Okay.
All right, well, we'll give Stephen and all of you a chance to think about that and come back at the end of the episode and we'll give you the answer. We want to talk a bit about how movies are seen these days. That sounds like a pretty simple question. You put a movie on and you watch it. But, yeah, well, it's a little more to it than that, right? Originally, when movies were made for many decades, pretty much the only way you'd see them is by going to a theater, and you see it on the big screen projected with a traditional film projector. And now, how many different ways can you see movies? Well, you can still do it the old way, but there might be digital projectors instead of film projectors, or you could watch it on a TV at home, or you could watch it on an iPod. You could watch it with other people or by yourself. There's a whole lot of variables that there never used to be. So how does that change the viewing experience of the movies? Stephen, I have a few items that I want to talk about, but let me just throw it over to you. How has this changed the world of movies?
Obviously, a lot of ways. I mean, I think the big change is while theatrical distribution still exists, I would go out on a limb and say that people see far more movies in non-theatrical venues than in theatrical venues. You know, if you're a heavy movie goer, well, that means you see, what, more than 10 movies a year in the movie theater, more than 5 movies a year in the movie theater. But even sort of casual movie viewers watch more than 5 or 10 or 20 movies a year at home, right?
Right,
I mean,
yeah.
We still think of theatrical as being the kind of default way to see movies. We think about seeing movies, we think about that, but that's the minority.
I've seen 10 movies in one day before.
Really?
Yes. Of course, you have to pick and choose when you do that, because you want to pick short movies.
That's a lot of movie watching.
Well, you know, occasionally it's kind of fun to just do a humongous marathon. anyway, yeah, definitely different. In the old days, before television, people went to the movies a lot more often than they do now. But even then, I mean, you go to a movie a week and that's 50 movies a year. That's still probably more than a lot of us do. But I saw 300 movies last year, so that's quite a bit more than 50. And so
you're hardly normal, though. We should be clear.
Most people aren't watching
300 movies a year.
Even you are more normal in this respect.
I don't watch that many movies.
Yeah. How many do you see? I mean, how often do you? One a week or something, or what?
Probably. I'd say it averages more than one a week. I'm probably closer to two or three.
Yeah.
And I think I see. Well, I know I see far more movies in the theater than you. I think I see between around 20 or 25 just in the theaters, and then probably another 100 or 200 at home because I watch a lot of movies on. Well, actually, can we count watching half a movie on cable? How does that work? Because I see a lot of. I'll watch Casino for an hour if it's on HBO. So there's a lot of that.
I don't count that at all because I don't do it at all. I watch a whole movie or nothing.
Okay. Well, I watch any portion of Casino is great. So if you come in halfway through and just have 20 minutes, it's still 20 minutes well spent.
So you and I are pretty excited about the art of making movies, which is probably why we do a podcast about it. So we are concerned with how movies should be seen. Obviously, Martin Scorsese did not intend that people watch an hour of Casino at a time and then just leave it off. Of course, you saw it once straight through.
Yes.
And so then that's okay. But you certainly shouldn't see it for the first time in pieces that are in random order.
You know what's interesting, though? Is that are there a lot of movies that I especially ones I saw as a kid where, like, I think I saw Alien and Aliens portions of them a million times before I ever sat down and watched them, like, on video as a teenager. Like, as a kid, I'd seen them a million times on like, cable. But it wasn't until I was quite a bit older that I sat down and really watched them. And that has had weird effects. I love both those movies, but had weird effects. Like, it was kind of interesting to sit down and watch them from start to finish. Like, oh, that's how it all fits together.
Well, I have two things to say about that. Number one, you're right. When you're a kid, that happens. There's some movies I've seen as a kid, in pieces, and you watch the full thing later. And then when I got more serious about movies, I made sure I never did that. But the second thing I want to say about that is, you were a kid when Aliens come out? Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway.
It was 86, right? I would have been four.
Little kid.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, okay. But anyway, we are concerned that movies should be seen in the way that the original filmmakers intended, or at least something that recaptures that environment as best as possible. So there's a few different ways people watch movies today, and I'm just going to ask you if you think that's okay to watch a movie that way or not, and be respectful of the artistry of these movies. So is it okay, would you say, to watch a colorized movie? Because that's one thing that happened sometime. I guess it happened more in the 80s and 90s than it does now. But if you have an old black and white movie, and maybe it'd be colorized to be more accessible to a broad audience, is that okay? This is a loaded question, because I'm going to fly over to California and punch you if you answer it wrong.
Obviously, the answer is no. I'm required legally to say that's not okay.
Go back to one of our first episodes where we talk about color to listen to more about why we think black and white is so wonderful. But yeah, a lot of movies just have to be in black and white. There's a specific feeling and look that the color just drains away. Plus, when you colorize a black and white movie, I mean, maybe the technology has gotten better, but the color looks really cheesy when you do it, too. It doesn't look quite right. It looks like somebody painted an Easter egg instead of what color might actually exist.
The big thing with adding color, and this is a theme we'll probably get back to as we go through some of these, is that it distinctly changes the movie from what the filmmakers intended. So if you're trying to be respectful to the filmmaker's vision and to experience the movie the way they intended you to, then obviously you shouldn't watch a colorized film.
Yeah, and I think the thing to take away here is that black and white is not a choice made because they didn't have the money to film in color. And, well, maybe in some cases it was, but even in those cases, if somebody's shooting something in black and white, they're going to design the look of it to be in black and white, and they're going to use compositions and lighting patterns that are effective in black and white. And if you colorize that, you're basically erasing all of that. You're not really adding anything. When people use color on purpose, then they're going to use it in a way that complements the material. So another subject, aspect ratio changes. And this is another thing that doesn't happen quite so much anymore, but definitely in the era of VHS and before high-def TV caught on, you would have those warning messages at the beginning of a movie saying, you know, this is not the theatrical version. It's been changed. It's been formatted to fit your screen. And basically that's code for we chopped the left and right sides of the picture off so it could fit your TV screen. Now, if you have a standard definition television screen, the aspect ratio is 4:3. That means the height of the screen is going to be 3/4 of the width of the screen. Well, movies, at least since the early 50s, don't have those dimensions. It would be quite a bit wider, in some cases over twice as wide as the height. And so to fit it on your TV screen, you have to crop the edges or do what's called letterboxing, which is more familiar to us, I think, now than it was 10 or 20 years ago, where you have the black bars on the top and bottom. You're not missing anything on the top and bottom. It's just shrinking the widescreen image down so that it fits in the width, and that naturally leaves some black on the top and bottom of the screen. But if you don't do that, you crop the sides, and is that okay?
Again, generally speaking, the answer is probably no, because it's significantly changing the look of the film that the artists put together. But this one gets all kinds of tricky. For instance, we all think, hey, we got our widescreen TVs, we're good, right? Except the most common widescreen format in use today is actually a slightly different aspect ratio than our widescreen TVs, right? Most film is shot at an aspect ratio of 1.85:1, meaning that the width is 1.85 times the height. Well, widescreen TVs are actually at 1.78:1, which is ever so slightly not quite as wide. So if you see a movie that's been shot in 1.85, it gets sort of cropped to 1.78, which much less of a difference than going to the 4:3 old television style, but still definitely a noticeable, well, probably really hard to notice, but it is a slight difference. Is that okay? I guess I would say probably yeah, because it's slight, but I don't know if it's ideal.
Yeah, I think it's mostly okay, because that is a lot less dramatic. But it depends on the compositions, I think. A lot of film directors, especially today, know that what they're going to be projecting to a lot of their audience is not going to be the aspect ratio that they're filming in. So they design their compositions so that when you cut off the left and right sides, it doesn't look so bad. But in other movies, they take advantage of the full width of the frame, and you have maybe several people standing in a line, and they go right to the left and right edges. And if you see a lot of movies cropped, sometimes you'll just see, you know, some of the people, and somebody will be talking off screen because they're just not visible on your screen, and that's really too bad when that happens. Or a lot of widescreen panoramas of scenery or whatever just doesn't look quite right. There's a lot that goes into the composition of an image to make it look aesthetically pleasing to the eye or draw your eye into certain areas of the screen, and if you just arbitrarily mangle that to fit whatever screen you're projecting on, you know, you're not going to be preserving the power of the art there.
Now, here's an interesting question. What do you do with, like, Stanley Kubrick movies, which were presented theatrically widescreen, but for which the director preferred the 4:3 ratio?
Yeah, he's flat out wrong. He is. I mean, if he was designing the composition of the images with the idea in mind that it was going to be cropped to 4:3, then that's not so bad, especially if he oversaw the formatting to fit the 4:3 aspect ratio. I don't know if he ever did or not. And then some movies, like The Shining, was shot in 4:3.
Well, no, we should be clear. Everything's shot on the same type of film. It's just whether you crop it or not for theatrical release. So The Shining was shot on just sort of with a regular non-anamorphic lens, I believe. I think it was cropped to 1.85 for theatrical, but he always preferred the uncropped 4:3 image.
Yeah, but again, it depends, because some directors will film a 4:3 image and intend it to be projected on a 1.85:1, and that, if you see boom mics and stuff, that's because that masking wasn't done correctly.
Right.
They shot the 4:3, didn't worry about boom mics being in the top of the frame because the intention was that you would never see that part of it.
Right.
Now, if Kubrick wants to do the same thing, but design the composition for the 4:3, then, you know, can't argue with that.
So, when you watch The Shining at home, should you watch it in 4:3 or 1.85?
Well, I think The Shining is a 4:3. I mean, that's I think that was specifically designed to be a 4x3, regardless of how it was in the theater. But I don't know that that's the case with all his movies. I'm not entirely sure, but I think some of them may have been designed at 1.85:1. But it's just that Kubrick didn't like those black bars on the top and bottom, so he's like, well, crop it. That looks better. That's less distracting.
Well, I think he actually also preferred the look of the square frame.
Yeah.
It better fits certain things. Like, I think we talked about human faces, which Kubrick loved, are square, not wide.
At least most people's.
True.
Yeah.
The other thing is, certain Kubrick movies like Strangelove is actually multiple aspect ratios, and it changes throughout the movie, and that's all kinds of odd.
The Dark Knight's like that too, right? Because the IMAX segments are not as wide as the others.
That's true. And so they did a weird thing with the home video of that, because the DVD, the regular DVD, everything's in 2.35, the very wide aspect ratio. The Blu-ray switches between 2.35 and 1.85, or actually 1.78. So that's a lot of numbers thrown around. But on the Blu-ray, you actually do get the IMAX kind of aspect ratio switching, which is cool, but also a little bit distracting for me.
So I wonder why, though. Why did we have all these strange aspect ratios when it seems clear to me that the ideal aspect ratio would be 1.618:1? Because that is the golden ratio, and it is known to be aesthetically pleasing to the eye. That's the ideal ratio. It's seen in nature and in art just absolutely everywhere. So why aren't our movies 1.618:1 all the time? You can even do weird things like if you take a beautiful human face, male or female, take somebody who looks really attractive, and then just measure the ratios of different things, like the width of the nose compared to the width of the mouth. There's just dozens of different measurements you can take in the face that, if it is an attractive face, will be the ratio 1.618:1. That's really fascinating that it appears everywhere. So why not everything be projected in that ratio, or at least something projected in that ratio? But it's not. Oh well. And we're getting off topic.
I think you've got a new replacement. You can outdo 3D, Stoddard vision, and it'll be in the golden ratio.
Oh, awesome. Okay, I'll do that. I'll work on that immediately. So I guess our conclusion is it's not quite clear what you should do about aspect ratio changes, except that you should try to do whatever the director intended, or the cinematographer, whoever's in charge of the compositions. And I think we do a pretty good job of that now with DVDs, but definitely if you watch some old VHS tapes of widescreen movies, I mean, don't even bother. It's not even worth watching them that way anymore. The widescreen versions are so much more accessible. There are other ways that movies are changed. Here's one. If you watch a movie on network television, there's three different things that happen differently. One, you get commercial breaks inserted randomly throughout the movie. Two, they could be time compressed. Time compression is just a way to adjust a movie so it fits a time slot. You got a two-hour movie, and I don't know what it is, 36, 37 minutes of commercials in that two-hour time slot, so you have to have a movie that runs for an hour and 20-something minutes. Well, how do you do that if it doesn't fit exactly there? Because movies are all different lengths. You time compress them, and what that means is, well, just cut movies here and there. Like, if there's a scene that runs long, cut it short. And then you saved yourself a couple seconds. You can shave off seconds here and there, or just eliminate entire scenes that don't appear to be necessary to the essential plot. So there's a lot of different things you can do with time compression if it doesn't happen to work out to be the length of the time slot you have. And the other one, the other way movies are changed, and this is true of a lot of other ways you watch movies too, you're watching them on a small screen instead of a big screen. Now, and actually, there's one more, but I'll talk about it later. What do you think of those three different changes, Stephen?
Not a big fan of them.
Any of them. Okay. So we've talked in the past on this podcast about seeing movies on the big screen versus small screen, so we can kind of glide by that one. I mean, I think the big screen is always going to be better. They were designed to be larger than life, and that's why stars were stars, and the age of the movie star isn't really what it was. You could say in part that's because of tabloids, kind of demystifying the American stars. But you could also say that people see them on the small screens now as much as on the big screens, where they're just huge and loom in front of you and are larger larger than life. But to go to the theater, there's a lot of other things you have to contend with too, such as maybe rude audiences and so forth. I mean, that's a personal trade-off. But with regard to commercial breaks and time compression, I mean, what are the problems there?
Basically, I mean, and commercial breaks are probably the most egregious of these, that it just completely breaks the flow and the rhythm of the movie. And it's worse depending on what kind of a movie you're watching. But if you're watching like a taut thriller and there's a commercial break every 12 or 15 minutes, that really kind of kills the pace of it, right? There's maybe something we didn't talk a little bit about in our TV episode, but it goes there too. One of the reasons like Lost plays better on DVD is they're not constantly breaking the tension to try to sell you a car.
Yeah, and I think the time compression issue is the same thing. You're changing the pace of the movie.
Exactly.
Sometimes it's very subtle. I mean, you can think, well, I just watch movies for entertainment. I don't really want to analyze the art behind it. But the art behind it is why an entertaining movie is entertaining. If you have a thriller, for example, as Stephen mentioned, it's possible that there are subtle things you're not aware of that are amplifying the tension, the pace of the cuts. You have maybe in the beginning the cuts are slow, the takes are longer, and then gradually as it goes, maybe it speeds up a little bit. You don't notice that except that you maybe have this subconscious suggestion that things are tightening up, that are moving a little faster, a little more out of control. I mean, they're very subtle things that you can do that the movie's dependent on to be effective. And you know, I think commercial breaks and time compression both mess that up in a big way.
Absolutely.
So there is another, I said there was a fourth change, and this is also true of other projection methods as well, and that is to project a film digitally as opposed to the traditional film way of having a frame shining a beam of light through it and then flicking the light off, advancing the next frame and flicking the light on again. I mean, that's how a film projector works. It does that 24 times a second, and we see flashes of images 24 per second, and they register in our brains as motion. Well, if you project a film digitally, that's not what you're doing. Like, if you watch a movie on a computer screen, what you're seeing is the image of a frame, and then as it updates to the next one, it's going to go pixel by pixel, updating to the next frame. And so you don't see the next frame all at once. You see it gradually being written over the old frame. Now, again, this happens much too fast for you to notice consciously, but there have been studies that show that this has a different effect on your brain. If you watch film the traditional way, the flashes of images you get put your mind into, I guess they call it a reverie state, and it makes you more alert. It's just a different frame of mind. If you watch it the video way, those updating pixels would have the opposite effect and kind of make you a little more lethargic, a little more zoning out, I guess. I think you can fall asleep in front of a video movie a lot more easily than you can in the theater. Of course, you know, there are other environmental issues there as well, obviously. And some people do fall asleep in the theater. But, you know, the general idea is it does affect your state of mind as you're watching it, and therefore possibly also its effectiveness. Do you buy this science, or is it not quite there?
It's hard to tell. You can't really get a controlled experiment. I don't know. Certainly they look different, though. I think we can agree to that. Like, projected film looks different than projected digital, looks different than watching a television.
And that at least could have an impact on how you receive the movie, right?
Oh, absolutely. Especially considering it also depends on how the film was shot. I think Michael Mann's digital films play possibly better on video than they do in the theater. I know maybe we've had this discussion before, but when I saw like Collateral in the movie theater, I didn't like it, and I thought the digital looked weird on the big screen. And when I saw it at home, I liked it quite a bit. And I think part of it was it just felt more right on a digital monitor, on a TV. And, you know, I know you're not a big fan of the Mann digital look, but I've kind of grown to appreciate it. I think his stuff plays pretty well on video because it looks already kind of video-ish. It has that look that I associate with video, for better or worse.
Well, I will say that although I am not a fan of shooting digitally, it's a different thing as to whether how I feel about it projected digitally. But, you know, the Michael Mann look, I'm not a big fan of, but I did love Collateral. And I saw that first on video, so maybe you're onto something there. But then you can go the other way, too. There are movies that are designed for that film projection. And this could be like some of the early movies of Sergei Eisenstein. The movie October has some interesting cuts in it. You have really fast cuts, a guy shooting a machine gun, and every shot on the soundtrack is associated with a cut. So you see back and forth between the shooter and what's being shot. I can't imagine that would play as well on video, where you're updating frames line by line. You need the flashes of the frames to get the effectiveness of that. And then there's some more experimental film, like there's this series of short films called Dog Star Man, that were made, I think, in the 60s, experimental cinema, you know, basically people on drugs shooting movies for people on drugs. But some of the imagery in that only lasts for one frame. You see flashes of one frame. Here's an image, now here's another one, here's another one. And I have to think that on some level, you know, the effectiveness of those is to show you an image fast, here it is, and then blink it out and replace it with another one. Kind of burn that image in your mind subconsciously. And if you're seeing it on video, you don't really have that bam. I don't know.
Of course, what is exciting is the notion that we can get much faster refresh rates on video these days. You know, they have TVs now that update at 240 hertz, which is 10 times the speed at which film is normally captured. Imagine getting rid of like traditional motion blur if we start capturing at that rate as well.
Yeah.
Film projectors can never really hope to match 240 frames per second. The cost would be astronomical. So there might be some good things in going toward more and more of a digital look.
That's a good point. Maybe as the technology progresses, this will be less of an issue. And you know, I'm not 100% convinced that it's an issue now either, but at the moment, at least, I find the arguments that there is an important distinction here a little bit more persuasive.
I agree. They definitely look different.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the zoning out thing.
So here's another one. A lot of movies were not shot in stereo. They were shot in mono. So you had mono sound, or when stereo sound did start to come around, you'd have two channels. Well, now we get the surround sound, you know, 5.1 Dolby Digital. I don't know all the audio terms, but, you know, you have five speakers around you and a subwoofer, and what's the deal with that? Well, you know, today, if you have a revival of an older movie, either in the theater or when you release it to DVD, lots of times those mono tracks will be remixed to stereo. Now, what do you think about that? Because that's obviously different than the original director's intention, isn't it?
Well, first of all, funny anecdote. I'm like the go-to guy for Blu-ray, for borrowing Blu-ray. So everyone who gets a new Blu-ray player, they come to me and say, what can I borrow? What can I borrow, right? Because I got a bunch of Blu-rays. So people have been slowly buying them at my work, the Blu-ray players. And so guys like, you're just tearing through my whole collection. So we started getting the more eclectic stuff. It's like, what is this Third Man movie? I'm like, that's great. You should check it out. I got the Third Man Criterion on Blu-ray. It's awesome. He watched it. He's like, yeah, it was okay, but what's up? It was freaking mono. Why are you giving me a Blu-ray that's got a mono soundtrack on it? So I understand at least why they do it. There's a commercial motivation. You know, if you're putting stuff in DVD or in Blu-ray, people who are renting them or buying them, you know, they may not expect it to be in mono. They may be disappointed if it is. Personally, I'm fine with a mono mix. I've got a 7.1 sound system, so I appreciate nice new movies with their great audio tracks, but I've never like been watching The Third Man and thought, this would be a lot better if the rear channels were getting more of a workout here. Although, you know, it's really detracting from the flick. That said, I guess I'm okay. It's a little tricky here because the audio stuff is usually a lot more subtle, so even when they remix a movie into 5.1 and it's an older movie, I think it's more for marketing than anything. I mean, what they end up happening is all the activity is at the front, like in the center channel, with every now and then a little bit of stuff in the rear just so they can check that 5.1 tick mark on the back of the box.
In a way, that could be more distracting, though, than if the whole movie were designed with five channels in mind, though, right? Because then
yeah,
you'd have the sound from the back coming all the time. And then, but the way it is now, you know, if every 20 minutes, oh, there's sound back there. Well, that's weird. I mean, doesn't that take you out of the movie or not?
Yeah, well, the fact is most movies, most of the action in the speakers is up front, because that's just how we expect. Just crowd noise and stuff, unless it's like an action movie, you don't hear a lot of stuff in the surround or the center surround. You know, I've listened to 5.1 versus 7.1. It's really hard to tell the difference with those two extra speakers. Yeah, I don't know. I don't find it that distracting. Like, I think we were talking about the North by Northwest restoration, which is on DVD and Blu-ray, has a 5.1 track. And for the most part, it's kind of sounds like a mono track. But then when you get to the infamous crop duster scene where Cary Grant is fleeing from this, you know, rogue crop duster that's trying to gun him down, that all goes to the rear speakers. And I was listening to it, I was like, whoa, first of all, I didn't realize it was really 5.1 up until that point. I assumed it was like, you know, a mono or a stereo mix. And then all of a sudden I hear that, I'm like, wow, that's really cool. And I thought, obviously Hitchcock never intended me to hear this, but I also feel like if Hitchcock had been alive, he would have made that, you know, sound really cool in 5.1. So maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm lying to myself and I'm justifying, but I think probably it's the kind of thing that the director wouldn't have minded, but it certainly is changing the vision.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there. I think if you have somebody who does that stuff well, then it's going to be okay. And I absolutely think that if Hitchcock had that technology around, then he probably would have used it, especially in that scene. But again, it's not Hitchcock doing it. It is some technician who's, you know, coming along after the fact and changing the final product. So I guess technically probably shouldn't be done, but you know, like you, I don't have this great righteous indignation that it is done. But the fact there's a commercial demand for it is not persuasive to me at all, because, you know, in the VHS era, there was commercial demand for cropping the sides. And I mean, the whole motivation behind colorization was that there's a commercial demand for that. And you know, I don't care if there's a commercial demand. I mean, maybe that's why it's done, doesn't make it okay.
True.
But, you know, for the audio stuff, and part of it is I have to admit, I'm not an audiophile. I mean, I love sound. I love music. I'm not real good at listening to sound the way true audiophiles are. You know, some people, oh, that's a 32,000 kilohertz tone. They can listen to music and hear all the different lines and melodies in something. I just hear the whole thing, and I can't really separate it out without a lot of conscious effort.
Same here. I'm tone deaf.
So maybe we're the wrong people to ask about this, but I think that change is okay.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, if you read the classic film websites and stuff, the people that keep up on this and the community, people don't complain about that. In fact, they generally kind of like it versus, you know, if you colorized an old movie, they'd go ballistic. So I think we're not the only ones who are more accepting of it.
Okay. Well, this is going to lead slightly into another topic I want to cover, and that is film restoration. Now, film restoration is big. It's important to preserve our history. I think I've mentioned before, 90% of silent movies are lost. The ones we have are the 10% that survived getting melted down on purpose or fires in studio vaults. The ones that do survive decompose. I mean, especially movies made before 1950 are made on a nitrate stock for the most part, which is not only very flammable, but also decomposes after time. So if you want to preserve old movies, it's important to have restoration efforts. And I think now we're seeing a lot of film restoration efforts, in part because the older libraries are decomposing and need restoration to have any kind of release. But when you restore something that's been damaged, you're basically changing it. You're trying to change it back to what it was, but you can't really get it all right. There's color correction to do. You can try to remix the sound effects or restore those. You know, there was a restoration done on the movie Vertigo a few years back, and I remember reading that a lot of people found the sound a little disconcerting because the sound effects were remixed in a way that didn't feel quite right to the people who know that movie well. I don't have an opinion on that particular case, but, you know, the point remains, you have to restore these movies if you want to keep them. But the act of restoring does change them in some way.
Right.
But, you know, there are good ways to do that. You can try to just eliminate artifacts in the picture and the audio. If there's clicks and pops in the audio, you can try to take those out. If there's scratches or marks in the picture, you can try to restore those. What they do is, like, if there's one frame that has a scratch in it, you look at the frame before and the frame after to get the image, and you average the picture in that damaged area, and then you can replace the damaged area that average. And then when you watch it, it looks fine. It looks perfect. But then there's other things you can do. You can touch up the special effects, maybe. This is a temptation that some people have, especially George Lucas, who, his Star Wars movies were not just restored, they were remade. And even his THX 1138 movie, when he went back and made the special edition of that, couldn't resist touching up the special effects, which, wish he wouldn't do that. If he does it and keeps the old version available, then maybe that's okay.
Right.
But I wish he wouldn't do that. And then there's other things, too, like... I've talked about the James Bond DVDs. All the movies were restored. And on one of the discs, there's this special feature about the restoration process. And the guy who headed up that effort talks about what he did to do the restoration. And you see some before and after shots that are pretty interesting. And then he also talks about this one part in one of the movies, The Man with the Golden Gun, where there's this fight scene in front of a mirror. And if you look in the mirror in that scene, you can see the crew. You can see like the guy with the camera filming the action and a couple guys standing around next to him. And the guy who headed up the restoration effort went to the filmmakers and said, well, we can fix this if you want. This is not a restoration effort, though. This is a content change. So, you know, we're going to ask you. We're not just going to do it. We'll ask you, hey, do you want us to fix this blooper or not? You know, which way do you want to do it? And he says, well, you have to see the movie to find out which way it went. I'm going to spoil it for you now. They thankfully left the crew in there. The blooper is in the movie. But just the fact that the question was raised shows you that there is this temptation when you're doing restoration work to maybe change some other things as well. So about this North by Northwest DVD, when you watched it, you sent me an email and were just effusive with praise and admiration about the work they had done with that.
Yeah.
You can talk a bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, part of it, the cool thing is it's a Blu-ray, so it's the high-definition transfer. And I've kind of been waiting for more older movies on HD, and last year was a pretty good year for that. We got a lot of them. We had a couple early on. Warner did a really good high-def release of The Adventures of Robin Hood, the 38 film, which is, you know, a really great movie and looked great. But by and large, some of the older movies we've released on Blu-ray have looked okay. Like the Casablanca Blu-ray, you're really hard-pressed, in my opinion, to tell the difference between that and the regular DVD. I put them on like side-by-side and could barely tell which one was which.
The regular DVD is unusually great, though.
That's true. So maybe it's wrong to expect more. But when I watched the North by Northwest disc, it felt like I was watching a movie from last year. It looked so crisp. The colors were so good. There are a couple of shots where clearly the original footage wasn't great because suddenly the quality degrades significantly. But it's a really good balance in terms of how it's presented. We've kind of had issues with how old movies should be presented, especially on the high-def formats like Blu-ray, where you can really, really see detail. Like, the Patton release on Blu-ray took a lot of flack for being really, really cleaned up to the point where it doesn't really look a ton like film. It's very, very digital-looking in that there's almost no film grain. We talked about the difference between film and digital and the way they look. Well, Patton looks more like it was shot on digital, almost, which upsets people who like the film look, and that was definitely a very film-looking kind of movie. Whereas you compare it to the Godfather trilogy on Blu-ray and the recent DVD re-release of those movies, which look really, really grainy, almost to the point where sometimes it's a little distracting, where they were really trying to make it look like a 70s grainy film, which I guess is sort of correct in one sense, but maybe incorrect in the other. I mean, should you change the look of the movie a little bit for the new medium? When you watch... I've shown the Godfather disc to people, saying, like, you know, here's a great-looking older Blu-ray, and they're like, why does it look so grainy? And it is a little distracting. I personally think it looks good. I like it. I don't mind it. But it's a consideration.
So what is the film grain? You know, is it just some noise in the dark areas sometimes you get? I associate that more with digital. You know, what's film grain? What does that look like?
It's hard to describe. There's two things at work here. I guess there's kind of three things that look kind of similar, get confused with one another. There's film grain, which is related to being able to sort of see the actual chemicals that are used to capture film. When you watch like a movie projected, you can see grain. It looks like little specks all over the picture. In fact, if you go next time you go to the movies, unless you're seeing a digital projection probably, if you really look, you can see film grain. It's like if you take a photograph, and again, it's got to be an actual real photograph, and get up real close to it, you'll see lots of little dots in it. It's kind of like looking at pixels if you get close to a monitor, though different, same underlying kind of principles. You'll actually sort of see the chemicals in the film. It's also digital noise, which is kind of its own thing, and closely related to that is compression artifacts, right? I guess maybe they're really one and the same. So when you were kind of alluding to this earlier when you talked about restoration and taking the average of the frame before and after, when we put movies on digital formats, they have to represent them, and because you have a limited amount of space, often you can't, or for a reason don't want to, represent the same level of information that would be found on the original piece of film. So you do what's called compression, which everyone who's familiar with computers has compressed things before. Essentially, what you're doing is throwing away information that you hope is needless. So what happens a lot is that you end up making the file itself smaller, but you've thrown away information. And one of the common ways that happens is, maybe if you're going to represent an image as a computer image, right, so you scan a piece of film, now it's a computer file, it's really a collection of a bunch of pixels, basically little dots of different colors. What you can say is, instead of having every single pixel from the original image on our final file, we're just going to say we're going to have half the number of pixels, and then, you know, the pixels that are missing, we'll just go out and kind of average them into their neighbor pixels, so we'll change the entire look of the image. And they have all kinds of clever algorithms that are much, much smarter than the idiotic one I just described, but that's the basic idea. And so what you'll often see, though, is parts where the algorithm kind of falls apart and throws away the wrong information or makes the wrong choices, like in fast-moving things or in really dark areas where it's having trouble averaging out the pixel information. You'll see like weird flickering or kind of square blocky looks. The square blocky look that you see on TV a lot is because the digital signal from the cable company is super compressed. Or on, you know, poor quality DVDs and stuff, you'll see weird little pixels in dark areas like you talked about.
This is getting off the subject a little bit, but hearing you talking about compression made me remember something really fascinating about the human eye. You can adjust compression algorithms to be optimized for human consumption, which is an interesting idea. And you can depend on the fact that the human eye sees green much better than red or blue, and especially blue. I mean, red and green we perceive pretty well, blue not at all. And so you can compress the blue part of an image more than the green and red and get an image that you can't really tell the difference. Well, here's what I mean. Let's say you took an image and separated it into its red, green, and blue components. So if you did that, you would essentially be looking at the image in three different ways, but one would be, you know, kind of like black and white, except it'd be red and black. And then you'd have the green and black image and the blue and black. And then you can compress the blue image so that, let's say, you know, you only have half as many pixels across and down as you do in the original image. So the blue pixels would be four times as big, extra blocky. But then you recombine it with the red and green, and your eye doesn't really notice that. Now, if you did the same thing with green as opposed to blue, then you would. The image would look much blurrier. But in fact, the amount of compression you're doing is the same. It's just that you're doing it with the green instead of the blue. If you come to our website, allmovietalk.com, I'll try to remember to put a link to a demonstration of this where you can see how dramatic the difference is. So you're throwing away information, but you're throwing away the specific information that the human eye is not good at perceiving in the first place. Why do you compress in the first place, though? Because, you know, there's a limit to the amount of data you can put on a disk.
Right. And not only that, but you actually have to, in order to take a piece of film and transfer it into a computer, you have to, at the very least, encode it and change it and make decisions. So, I mean, even before you even kind of talk about compressing it, you're already, just by the act of transferring it from one format to another, making important changes to it.
Yeah, now if you think this is all just a superficial kind of change, here's a little anecdote that maybe not change your mind. There's the movie Beauty and the Beast from 1946, directed by Jean Cocteau. And I was just reading about this movie and ran across a little factoid here that he used several different kinds of film stock. So obviously they didn't have digital in those days. It was all film, but different kinds of film gave him different looks. And the film grain would change from scene to scene because he'd be using different film stock. And the reason he did this was not an artistic reason. It was the fact that this was right after World War II in France, and he had to use whatever materials he could get his hands on. So it was hard to get film stock. He used what he could, and the result was a mix of film grains. But, you know, because of that, he said that it turned out that the different visual textures added to the poetic effect of the film. Interesting, but, you know, at least in his opinion, this film grain look had an important effect on the final movie. There's a little movie out there right now. What's it called? It's so obscure.
Yeah, is it The White Ribbon? Something? No.
No, that's something else.
Okay.
The Aviator. No. That The Aviator. No, that was.
Oh. No, it's not.
It's close, right?
I think so. It's a movie about flying. Some flying happens.
Avatar. That's what it is. It's Avatar. Little tiny indie movie called Avatar.
Oh yeah.
That's kind of making the round. It's
done, of course, based on Hindu mythology.
Fairly well, I guess, at the box office.
That's what I hear.
It's made a quiet $3 billion.
Something like, yeah. I guess we're recording this. We have no idea where it's going to end up at.
At the moment we're recording, it's looking like international grosses are going to be up around $2.8 billion. And just to give that number some perspective, the previous number one was Titanic with $1.8 billion. So we're going, over half again, or about half again.
However, according to my retarded math, only six people have seen Avatar,
right?
Because of the 3D premium and ticket price inflation. It's only been seen by six human beings. So really, if you think that's great, whatever. The average ticket price was like half a billion.
So let's break it down for people. The idea is most people seeing Avatar are seeing it in 3D. If you see it in 3D, you're paying an extra amount for your ticket than you would if you saw it in 2D or any other movie for that matter. And because of that, what's called the 3D bump, it means that Avatar's incredible financial success is completely null and void.
Right.
And its record should have an asterisk saying, only six people saw this, that's why it made so much money, it's just that they paid a premium.
And if Gone with the Wind had been released in 3D in 1939, it would have made like $1 trillion in 1939 dollars.
Yeah.
Easily.
Right. And that's another thing, inflation means that 1939 dollars are more than 2009 dollars, and so if you adjust for inflation, Gone with the Wind and Boys Town and Stagecoach and Reefer Madness have all made over $10 trillion in 2009 dollars. So really, Avatar is kind of a flop.
If you think about it, yeah. Well, the nice thing about the past, where there's no hard data, is you can just make up whatever you feel like. And then you're good because no one can prove you right or wrong, since really we have no... we don't really know within an order of magnitude how many people saw Gone with the Wind in the movie theaters. It's very unclear. So you just pick a number and no one can prove you otherwise. It was a billion people. A billion people in 1939 saw it. There you go.
Right.
And only six people seen Avatar.
Maybe we should let people in on the joke who don't know what we're talking about. There's an interesting controversy on random blogs that are probably best left unread, frankly. But there's some people who are mad that Avatar has had such huge success, and so they invent crazy ways and go to convolutions about how Avatar's financial success is not really that successful after all.
It's confusing. I don't understand. Where does this come from? It's like some deep-seated anger toward the movie that some people have.
Well, it's not special with Avatar. I mean, Titanic had the same thing. People loved Titanic until it became as successful as it did, and then it was a backlash there. And it became cool to dislike Titanic because everybody else did like it. And I knew people who were proud. I'm like one of the three people in the world who have not seen Titanic, and I don't intend to change that. I'm happy being a person who has not contributed to Titanic's success, which is silly. I mean, it's the same with everything. If something is praised enough, there's going to be backlash. And it seems to be in the internet age where hype makes the rounds very quickly that the backlash also comes very quickly. So, and we saw the same thing with Crash. It won Best Picture, and people disliked it a whole lot more after it won Best Picture than they did before. Some people started out not liking it for some reason, if you listen to this podcast regularly, that you know that Steven and I both like it. We both like Titanic. I guess we're immune to the whole backlash thing.
Well, it's now, because there's so much backlash against those movies, it's now hip to like them, because then you're backlashing against the backlash.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah, that's right.
We are the coolest cats in the room. So anyway, we frankly think all these arguments against Avatar are stupid. I mean, $2.8 billion over $1.8, and, you know, the next record down from Titanic is just over $1 billion worldwide. That's held by Return of the King. So essentially the number three movie in the world is a third. You can take Titanic and Return of the King, put them together, and you get what Avatar is making now. And that's not the 3D bump. That is just an incredible phenomenon. But what do we think about the movie itself? Does it deserve all this attention?
No. It's not a bad movie. It's always one of these things like the... Well, actually, I guess Return of the King's pretty great, but... Titanic was certainly not the greatest movie of all time. You know, we're both fans, but does it deserve the attention that it got? Probably not. It deserves a lot of attention, but not as much as it received.
Yeah, it's a tough call. And of course, it's not just how great a movie is. I mean, that's one metric, but then there are other metrics as well. I think the reason Avatar is making a lot of money is because it is a great experience, which is different from a great movie, or at least to say new, at minimum, an experience that really hasn't been done in movies before. So that's kind of fascinating and kind of makes it difficult for me to peg exactly how I feel about it.
I'm with you there. And I heard an interesting comment on the internet from one of the haters, which is, oh, so it's a great experience. So what? It's a theme park ride? We should use the same criteria that we'd use A Bug's Life at Disneyland or the Back to the Future ride at Universal Studios. It's up with those, because those are different experiences. And I guess kind of that's okay, but what's wrong with having a thrill park ride experience at the movies from time to time? You know, I'll defend you if you want to go see a crappy summer blockbuster, because I go and see them all, so I'm not going to feel bad about enjoying Avatar.
At the same time, though, if we say, well, it's a great experience, so we'll give it a pass, I mean, can't we say the same thing about... I mean, other people say to us, well, what about Transformers 2? You know, that's a thrill ride, and so what if it's not a great movie? It's a thrill ride, right? I mean, what's the difference?
Here's the thing about Transformers 2. It's not a good thrill ride. It's not... Like, and here's the thing. I'm the guy who saw Transformers 1 and said, you know, that wasn't horrible. I kind of enjoyed myself. It was the begrudging, vaguely positive review that I gave it. But Transformers 2 was just painful. So I'm okay with a fun thrill ride if it's, you know, fun and thrilling, which Avatar is at times and is definitely an interesting and entertaining experience. But, you know, best movie ever, highest grossing movie ever, does it deserve to be it? No.
So you actually reviewed this movie on our website, and you had a review of Avatar, and some of the responses were, I guess most of them were in agreement that it is, you know, great visuals and everything, but as a story, it doesn't really hold together well. I wrote you an email after I saw it, because I hadn't seen it at the time you reviewed it, and just quote myself here, I think that's the ultimate in pomposity, but I basically agree. It's a great visual experience and not a great movie, but I don't think that criticism, I don't know, it doesn't hold as much water with me as maybe it does with other people. The thing is, the visual experience is so great. Is it that big of a deal that it has a weak story? I mean, movies are a visual medium, and if the visual experience is amazing and unprecedented, isn't that enough to call it a good and maybe even a great movie? I would draw the comparison to other movies that are less controversially considered classics, like Un Chien Andalou by Louis Buñuel. That is a movie with no story. It is all imagery. Or more recently, the documentary Wing Migration. Or I don't even know how to pronounce this movie, Koyaanisqatsi. It's basically a movie with all great imagery and no story at all. And they are hailed as masterpieces. Well, you know, if a movie like that with no story and great visuals can be considered great, why not Avatar as well? So what if it's packaged together in a form that resembles a conventional bad movie, if the imagery is as great as is in these other classics, which I think it probably is, isn't that enough?
Well, I don't know. In my review on the website, I compared it to the Star Wars prequels, which I still think is a somewhat fair comparison. I guess that's a slam, depending on your point of view. But I thought The Phantom Menace was a pretty great visual experience in lots of parts. I saw it three times in the movie theater, so, which I don't know what that says about me, but I had a lot of fun watching that. The story and characters are pretty poor, but I had a good time. I think, has history been kind to The Phantom Menace the way it's been kind to Louis Buñuel? No. So it's an interesting question. Why not, perhaps? Part of it is, I think, no one understands Buñuel's movies, so they're inclined to give them a pass. And I like Buñuel, but when there's literally no story, how do you attack it? Like, what do you attack? Like, oh, I thought it was that eyeball slicing looked really unrealistic. I don't know. But when there's a story and it's done poorly and there are characters and they're drawn poorly, then I think, well, that's a valid criticism. Hey, look, if Avatar were maybe not 2.5 hours, but, you know, 90 minutes of just cool visuals with, like, no story, I could get behind that. I'd be okay with that. But there is a story, and it's, you know, if you're doing your job as a critic or a serious film goer, you have to kind of admit that the story and the characters are pretty weak.
Right, but if the visuals are the same, if they're just as great as if there were no story, then, you know, how is it weakened at all?
Well, you have to sit there watching the terrible character scenes, right? Like, maybe if you could fast-forward past it and just get to the cool parts, that'd be one thing, but...
Well, I'm going to go ahead and refute my own point, because
okay.
I do see the other side of it. It is true, you know, if you watch, like, Unchained Andalou, you don't forget that. The imagery is not just great, fantastic imagery. It just burns in your mind. I mean, that scene with the ants on the hand, the eyeball, and things like that, you don't forget them. There's something about that imagery that worms its way into your psyche and just clicks with you, as opposed to Avatar, where the imagery, great as it is more or less adrenaline. And, you know, what happens with adrenaline, it wears off. And I really felt like Avatar was just amazing at the time. As an experience, it was just great. And then walking out of the theater, it doesn't even last that long after you've left. And I've experienced this with other movies that are less fascinating, but, you know, I was caught up into it at the time, and the moment the credits start rolling, I'm like, yeah, so that experience is over. As opposed to with a better movie, it sticks with you over time. I think we've talked in the past about, you know, the movie Barton Fink and how I didn't quite know how I felt about it at the time, and as time went on and my mind sort of processed it, it just became greater and greater in my head. And Avatar, kind of the opposite there. So, you know, I would refute my own point and say that even though it's a great experience, it's not one that's very sticky.
Right. And again, though, I do think there's something to the fact that you can't really pick apart the story in a surrealistic movie. It's not there to pick apart. Whereas when you stop thinking about Avatar and the images fade because they're not as striking as a Buñuel, then what you're left with, what you remember better, is actually the story and the characters. And so, hey, you can go ahead and pick them apart. And it's pretty easy to do in a flick like Avatar or, you know, The Phantom Menace.
So what is the story that has the problems? What is, maybe we could just, instead of just saying, it's a bad story, let's talk about what should have been better about it. What's the problem with the story here?
Well, I think the big problem is we've seen it all before, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's a bad thing when you don't do anything else with it. You don't take the material in a new direction. You know, even before the movie came out, people were ragging on it, calling it Dances with Wolves in Space or whatnot. But that's kind of a fair assessment of the storyline of the movie. I'm this Western, modern, technological capitalist guy, and I'm going to go learn about the natives and then fall in love with one of them and then eventually join their cause and try and fight some battle against the imperialistic technological Westerners. So that's something, you know, that we've seen a lot of in the last 30 or so years, maybe. It's not that fresh. And even worse, because you could live with that story. That's Dance with Wolves is a good, you know, not great, but a good movie. You could take that and make a good movie out of it. But the next problem is that I think the characters just aren't there. I've been running this experiment with people who are big defenders of the movie, and I basically ask them to name any of the other Na'vi, the aliens, other than the female lead. Like, can they name one? And most of them can't, because the society is composed entirely of the same character. You know, they look cool, but really they have just really stock archetypical characters with no real interest to them and no apparent desires or motivations other than what the plot requires of them. And same thing for most of the human characters. I think the protagonist, played by Sam Worthington, does a pretty good job. He has a fairly realized arc, But it's such a typical hero's arc, there's nothing surprising in it. And then kind of everyone around the periphery just seems like a stereotype.
Yeah, I agree. I think for me, what would have made it a much better movie is if there were a little more complexity in the characters and not just pick a side. You know, how about the alien character who has a reason to maybe side with the enemies? Or maybe, well, I guess there are a few with the human characters who take the opposite side, but, you know, they're not really given great reasons for doing so. I mean, I would love to have more personal stories in some of the secondary characters, just enough to give you the illusion that they maybe have minds of their own and are,
right.
If they join a particular side, maybe they're doing so for their own reasons instead of just they see the light and these other characters don't.
I mean, think about the Michelle Rodriguez character. We know nothing about her. We don't really know why she makes the decisions that she makes, and they're critical decisions, but it's just, well, the plot requires her to do X, so she's now going to do X.
Right. And I'll just also add, for me, the whole spiritual angle and the anti-capitalist bent to it, it just tires me out. It's so annoying.
I'm just annoying. I'm okay with it. I think I have more tolerance for that than probably you do, but you got to do something more than just have it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm with you. I would have liked to have seen, and if you're going to be realistic about this, there should have been aliens who were siding with the humans. What, none of them wanted access to medicine or technology? Really?
Yeah.
A single one of them?
Right.
You never see any collaborators? Since in the history of imperialism and occupations, there have always been collaborators.
Right.
Why don't we get to see any of that? And what, the humans are pretty much just unabashedly evil, basically? They just, we're going to go get some money and kill these people, we don't care?
Yeah. It's kind of weird to see Cameron doing a movie with that kind of political slant to it, though.
Yeah, I mean, well, part of the problem is, like, the Giovanni Ribisi character, who is the head of the human corporation that's doing this, is basically the Paul Reiser character from Cameron's Aliens, right? I mean, it's the part where, clearly, Ribisi I think it's deliberate? It's unclear. It's channeling Reiser's performance. But, you know, Paul Reiser in Aliens is sort of a rogue agent to some extent. There's not, like, the sense that this is the official company policy. You know, the company's not a good guy, but Paul Reiser is particularly a bad guy. And even then, we get a little bit more nuance. We understand why he does what he does. He's sorry that people die. He didn't intend for anyone to get killed, but, you know, hey, we're talking about a lot of money here.
So, at this time of this recording, we don't yet know if Avatar is going to win the Best Picture Oscar. Maybe I'll get this episode packaged up before then, but is it going to win? What do you think?
I'm so bad at Oscar prognostication. The odds, it's the favorite, but I don't know. I have trouble believing that a big movie about blue cats can win the Best Picture.
Well, I think it has a better chance than it did before some other recent popular movies made it, and especially Lord of the Rings. You know, that was the first fantasy movie ever that it ever won, and,
yeah.
And now we're starting to see more of an acceptance of the big special effects blockbusters, but I kind of don't see it either. I don't know. We'll see.
I mean, look, Star Wars couldn't win Best Picture, or Empire Strikes Back. I mean, are you really? You're telling me that this is the sci-fi movie the Academy's going to go with? That would be awfully strange.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, for the Oscars, why don't you come to rinkworks.com, go into Rink Chat on the night of the Oscars, and we'll be chatting live as we're watching them. So if you can maybe get on a laptop and chat with us as you're watching the Oscars, you know, it's just a fun thing to do. If that's your thing, come and join us. It's the end of the episode, and that means that it is time for the answer to the trivia question, which was, what film did Mel Brooks and David Lynch collaborate on? Really, really strange pairing of talent there. Do you have any guesses as to what this is?
Well, I'm going to guess it's not a... I'm going to go with The Elephant Man.
Oh, wow! You are absolutely right. That is it. Why did you guess that?
Well, because it's not a very Lynchian movie in a lot of ways, and it's the kind of story that I could see Brooks being attracted to. Obviously, not what we think of when we think of Mel Brooks being wacky comedy, but I can kind of see, you know, the human element, and it's not obviously a project that Lynch would have originated, I don't think.
Okay, well, I'm impressed, and if you answered The Elephant Man there at home, or wherever you're listening to this, score yourself 1 point. Otherwise, you get nothing.
Well, that's about it for us today, but tune in next time, which will be around a month or so from when this airs, and we'll have a look back at 2009, including our thoughts on the Oscars, which we'll have concluded by then.
And speaking of the Oscars, when they air on Sunday night, you might want to drop into Rink Chat at rinkworks.com, rinkworks.com. And we're always live chatting there. You can join the chat room and we'll hang out and make fun of everybody as it goes out. Also on Rinkworks, it's your last chance to enter in the Academy Awards predictions game. So if you want to log into there, make some guesses as to what will win the Oscars. Well, there's a lot at stake. I mean, if you win, that could be all kinds of bragging rights or something. You know, we're not giving away books like we did before because it turned out that cost money. And then what else is going on? On the website, allmovietalk.com, you can read or participate in discussion about this episode and about other things, too. We started something new just last week with a top six list. If you missed the top six list that we used to do on the show, well, we'll have one per week every Friday. All right, so see you next time.